How do you find your purpose? How do you even minimize your suffering? And how can you control what you give your attention to? These are just a few of the topics we'll be exploring today on the Conscious Success Podcast, where we teach you how to master your mind, enhance your health, and expand your wealth. I'm your host, Madhu, and today I am so beyond excited to introduce you to my spiritual teacher, Vaisheshika Maharaj, who, if you like even a little bit what I say, you're going to love everything he shares because I learned the majority of it from him. He is a veteran monk, an international spiritual teacher, an author of various literature, a dynamic president of one of the most successful temples in the world. At the ripe old age of 16, he became a monk and has since dedicated over five decades to embracing, learning, and teaching these transcendental topics. After completing his monastic vows after several years, 13 years, I believe, he went on to build flourishing business while still maintaining the highest spiritual principles. Together with his wife, Nirakula, he leads and nurtures a vibrant spiritual community up in Silicon Valley and regularly travels worldwide to inspire and guide many dozens of centers, many thousands of individuals, hundreds of thousands virtually that consume the transcendental topics he shares on a virtual platform. And I'll have to share with you very vulnerably here that this is the most special podcast for me, because not only has he been the most influential person in my life, but the deepest sense of satisfaction and happiness I've ever received were from what I have learned from this most special guest. Please, my friends, I beg of you to give your full undivided attention to the topics you're going to be exploring here, because I can promise you by the end of our time together, not only will you have learned very practical tools for spiritual life, but you have understood topics you've probably explored for a long time way more in depth in a way that can not only improve the quality of your life, but show you how to improve the quality of lives of other individuals. Check this out. Okay, so this is one of the rare episodes where I'm really going to try to shut up and listen, because, again, this is one of the most special guests we'll probably ever get to have on this podcast. And I'm going to ask the question everyone that knows you will ask, and that is, at the age of 16, you left everything behind and became a monk at the ripe age of 16. Could you please share with us what would have inspired you to take such a radical direction at such an incredibly young age?
Well, it seemed like a good idea. I had looked at the world since kindergarten as a place that was uncertain. I think right when I graduated kindergarten, I was headed for first grade, is when President Kennedy got shot. And for some reason, that affected me deeply. I was thinking that if somebody in such a position could be violently taken away from the world, first, I didn't like the idea that people were at each other so much. That disturbed me. Like, why? And then the fact that he was such a glorified personality, handsome, wealthy, powerful, and then suddenly he was torn apart physically and died. And I started wondering what death actually meant. Around that time, too, we were subjected to the kinds of information that were going on at the time because of the Cold War about atomic bombs. That's what they were called then. And we practiced duck and cover in the classroom. And I'd ask my father what that was about. And when he'd describe how there would be a flash and the windows would all break. And I was thinking, why? Why do we have to do this? And then sometimes I'd think deeply about death. And I used to ask my older brother what it meant. At least I did one time. And he told me, well, it means when the end comes, then you become nothing. And I thought, well, I don't want to become nothing. How does that work? And it got me concerned enough to go to my parents and asked them, and I realized they didn't know either. Mm. And that gave me some existential angst. And that didn't subside, although I lived a normal life and did the kinds of stuff kids do. When I got to high school, there was a convergence of events in my life. A good friend of mine who was a super athlete got lost in the wilderness and nobody ever found him again. And I said, okay, that's it. And Also around that time, it was around circa 1972, that there was a lot of investigation going on. It was kind of a romantic period. Everyone wanted to know the purpose of life. It's in the music, and it's also in the intent of festivals like Monterey Pop, which I guess would have been when I was 11 years old. You know, everyone was saying this is a new era, it's in the songs. But then it didn't play out. I thought there must be something. And so I started looking for answers in different kinds of books. And I just happened upon a book called Be Here Now that was lying around in my brother's room. My brother's only 2.5 years older, but that meant a lot at that age. And I read that book in one night. I stayed up all night and read it and said, aha, there is more about death and so forth. And it came through in the various channels of books like the Bhagavad Gita I heard mentioned in there. And I read things like Mantra and Karma. And that's what really got me started on the quest for the ultimate. And it was a full-on push for that, so much so that it concerned everybody around me. that what happened? Maybe suicidal, maybe this, that, and the other thing. But I was just intent on getting some answers and really finding out what's the ultimate purpose of life. So that was the big push. And by the time I was 16, I found my path in the Bhagavad Gita. And then I found the teacher whose Bhagavad Gita, because there's many versions, resonated with me because it was very practical. And I saw that he had started a worldwide community with young people like me. And when I saw their pictures and they were doing work for the world to try to help people, they were out feeding people, they were printing books and working on printing presses, I said, that's me. I want to join that.
Why the Bhagavad Gita? Because you said Be Here Now, which I believe is Ram Dass.
It was Ram Dass.
Ram Dass.
Richard Alpert.
That's right. And there's different, I know from what you shared now and in other conversations that you mentioned, there's a lot that you explored in terms of Eastern spirituality. I want to look into two parts. So one is why the Bhagavad Gita in terms of the other alternatives? And then you mentioned out of all the even versions and translations or interpretations of the Gita, why was it the Bhagavad Gita as it is that stood out so much to you, that inspired you, aside from them having this mission you're mentioning of service orientation, helping others, etc.? I'd be curious about those two.
The Bhagavad Gita made sense to me. It's in one book, 18 chapters, not very long, and simple language. I had read many books, as you mentioned. I left that part out, but I'd gone to libraries and wherever I could. I mean, it's 1972, no internet. You go find what you can, right? And Martha Pollack, a friend of my brother's from school, saw that I was becoming spiritual. And I don't know why, but she gave me a Bhagavad Gita. It wasn't my spiritual master's Bhagavad Gita, but it was a Bhagavad Gita that just had translations and a little commentary in the beginning, a little book about this big. And said, here, check this out. It's like, wow, that's an interesting title. It sounds mystical.
Yeah.
And when I looked into it, I found that it answered my questions very quickly. For instance, the one question I mentioned before about death. The topic not only intrigued me, but it also worried me deeply. And I was relieved when I read the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, where in a very straightforward way, the speaker, who's the teacher to Arjuna, says, in essence, there is no death. It's only a change of positions. You're in one situation now and you'll change. And it didn't just leave it at that. There's a science behind it, the science of consciousness. And that was something going on at the time too. People were investigating through psychedelic drugs, and there was a kind of innocence in some of it before it just became status quo or overused or became a stimulus for like just partying or something like that, where people were actually interested in kind of breaking through. And I had that experience when I read the Bhagavad Gita, that this is a breakthrough. I felt it viscerally when I read it. I felt as if there was a voice speaking to me that resonated with the voice that was coming from in here. You know, that small, still voice within.
the conscience, as people call it. Yeah.
And I could say it's the same. And it intrigued me how when I read the Bhagavad Gita, I had this very direct experience. And I used to read it every day. I couldn't wait to get home from high school. I just sit down and read the Bhagavad Gita again and again, and it thrilled me. So it just became quite natural. It wasn't as much an intellectual stimulus, but it was more that I felt it spiritually, that it was helping me. I felt it was helping me see the world through a new lens that made sense to me.
So for anyone not familiar with the Bhagavad Gita, of course, I couldn't imagine a better way to present. It's like, if you don't want to go read the Bhagavad Gita now, something's wrong with you. I really appreciate the one point you made is that there are a lot of Gitas and everything can help. You know, any version can help put you in the right direction. But you had mentioned now and in other times that it was the Gita as it is by A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Well, just if you guys hear us use the term Prabhupada, that's the maybe abbreviated version to appreciate the author of the Bhagavad Gita as it is, who translated, which arguably is the most legitimately, or let's say authentically translated version of the Gita around. And so how did you wind up getting to the Gita as it is from the other versions?
As my friend Richie Corsa. It was amazing when I think back to it with my friends at high school. There's another friend, Richie, and he wasn't spiritually minded, but everybody knew I was. And he had received a magazine called Back to Godhead. That was a publication that my teacher started before he came to America, which is the first time he left India, and he was 69 years old when he arrived in America. But he had this publication that he started, and he continued it when he got to America. And somehow Richie, walking downtown Berkeley, near where I live in Northern California, the Bay Area, had received the magazine from a monk who was offering them on the street. And as he put it, you know, I didn't really want it. I'm not into this stuff. But he brought it to my house and he said, I know you're into this. So he left it for me. And when I read that, I saw there was an advertisement for a Bhagavad Gita as it is. And I thought, what's that mean? Incidentally, there was another advertisement for a book called Easy Journey to Other Planets that was a genius marketing thing from my teacher. I was like, I'll take that too. And at that time, of course, I hate to break this to people, but there was no Amazon back then. You couldn't just order books online. I had to go to Shambhala Books. My mother drove me. I didn't have a license at that age, but they had several titles by the author that was the author of the magazine, and he had several books out. So I went and got those. So Why did it become prominent? Why did I find it helpful? The framing of the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita helped me, because there were a lot of sections in the Bhagavad Gita that I found enigmatic. I didn't quite know what they meant. I thought I did, but then when I started reading the commentaries that my teacher had carried forward from antiquity, from teachers who had learned it through what's called disciplic succession. They had actually practiced the tenets of Bhagavad Gita and lived the lifestyle. And then they had received teachings from their spiritual mentors and then incorporated that. That's the tradition of passing the knowledge down. You actually have to live it. It can't just be academic. Now, one of the first sections I resonated with, I had become, as a teenager, before I found Bhagavad Gita, I became a vegetarian. I don't know why. Just one day it struck me. It's like, this is barbaric. That's how I felt. I mean, I just remember coming home on a summer night and declaring to my family, that's it. I'm not eating this stuff anymore. And they were like, what are you talking about? It's like, just what I said. And so I was already into that. And then when I got more spiritually oriented and I started reading the Bhagavad Gita as it is, and Prabhupada talks about how you can't have a spiritual philosophy and then be violent. You have to be as nonviolent as possible in a world where one living being is food for another. And I thought, finally, somebody said that, because I saw a lot of spiritual teachings and then they didn't mention it. And I thought, when those two concepts came together, that was the first thing among many that I said, I really like how I like the integrity of the teachings. They include not just humans, but all living beings. And I thought that's how a spiritual philosophy should be, is it should be universal. We should care for plants, animals, all living beings. And what to speak of the planet itself, he also talked about not exploiting resources just for wanton enjoyment. We should be respectful of the environment. We're just really, it's like living in a, what do they call it? Airbnb, and then trash in the place.
Yeah.
So.
If you've ever considered having a podcast, especially if you're expert at what you do, I cannot suggest more highly using Podigy's service, which is what we use. If you like this production here, I highly suggest you reach out to Podigy through their contact in the show notes below to run and host your podcast. I went through a bunch of different teams, tried a bunch of different things. No one came close to what I got post-production from Podigy. And even just making a launch easy, taking your content, sharing it, making it presentable, please check out Podigy. If you're great at what you do and you've ever considered having a podcast, I really am excited for you to try them out as well.
There were very practical points along the way when I said, oh yeah, this and this and this, and they added up so quickly. And then seeing that there was a lifestyle connected to it, an ashram, which was something I had hoped for, a place where I could go and learn it in totality. And so all of that was a package that I saw from my spiritual masters, my future spiritual masters' teachings that resonated with me.
So it's not necessarily just the philosophy, which was maybe even more complete than anything you, certainly more complete than all the other options you've seen in one cohesive place, but the lifestyle that people were actually living it, and not just, as you mentioned, academically repurposing it, something they read, but they've made it a part of their lifestyle. And then, as you mentioned, a place, a sanctuary, an ashram that you could be with others who are doing it. And so all of the, is like a culmination of years of curiosity and, as we say, super soul or divinity from within, kind of making it clear to move in one direction. And so you actually moved in at 16. Is that correct?
Yes. And that took a little doing because
yeah, please say
I had to tell my parents about that.
I imagine they had no challenges.
They were very liberal. My parents, I credit them for so much in my life. I'm so grateful to both of them. I like them very much too. And I feel bad sometimes that I flat left them at 16 because, you know, I could just imagine how they felt about that. Although I did come back to them later and fully participate in the family. But I had to. I had to get out of the orbit. A lot of teenagers do anyway. I just happened to find this outlet. And it was actually my mother took me to the first time to experience the ashram. They had a Sunday program open to the public that they held there at the ashram in San Francisco. And they had a temple there all with all the trappings of the teachings of Bhagavad Gita, and they had classes on it and things like that, plus the food, all vegetarian. And so she dropped me off, and I, first thing, as I was walking up to the door, there was a person there, looked like a monk, he was a monk, and I introduced myself, said, hi, I'm, you know, my name's William. I came here to check it out. He was hosing down the back alley and he said, you want to help? I said, sure. And I started immediately doing something. And then I went in and felt, wow, this place is clean, 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 clean. And then the whole program unfolded during that evening. And at the end, I asked somebody, how do I become part of this? And they said, well, how old are you, kid? I said, 16. They said, well, first thing, go ask your parents. So I went home and I told my parents that I'd like to join. And they said, well, you know, you haven't finished high school. How about doing that first? And also, you're not 18, so, you know, it's up to us. They said, but maybe it was summertime, August 1973. Said, maybe you want to just try it for a little while in the summer. Well, I did, but I just didn't come home, which to their credit, they supported me. They could understand that I was fully dedicated to this. It wasn't a fly-by-night decision. They had seen it unfolding in my life for a long time. So credit to my parents. They gave me that opportunity, and I took full advantage of it. For 13 years, I lived in an ashram, not always in San Francisco, but I was given opportunities in many places to go. And just, it was a simple life, just living, knowing I didn't have any responsibility in the normal sense of paying for things. I didn't even know what that meant as a 16-year-old anyway. But all I had to do was do service all day. And I was so happy. I felt like this can't be real. There's no anxiety in it. It's just spiritual practice all day long and doing work that resonated with my sense of trying to do good for others.
I have to share briefly, because a lot of people would have heard this before. I also was 16 when I read the Bhagavad Gita. And as I was just sharing with you on the drive over here is, for those unfamiliar, my father offered me $100 to read the Bhagavad Gita when I was 16. I really needed the money.
Great.
We came from a pretty simple upbringing. So $100 was like, I never made like that much in one sitting. So I was like, okay, I got to read this book. And fortunately, it was the Bhagavad Gita as it was and as it is. As it was, as it is, same. And after reading it, it changed my heart so much that I never even took the money. I was so enlivened by it. And I also wanted to, I was like, I want to meet these people who are teaching this. And I went to ashrams. And by this time, I was 17. And they said, 1 year, on your 18th birthday, you could come in. But it was actually more of a tactic. It was like, go home and prove that you could, you're serious enough. I just so much appreciate the diligence of these legitimate spiritual practitioners. You know, go check in with your parents, you know, make sure you're actually interested enough for a long period of time. And it's just interesting because for me, this was 40-something years, 45 years or whatever it might have been after you had that same experience. And certainly if we go back a few hundred years, the practitioners of bhakti practice would also be representative in this way where it's not just leave everything behind. It's very much practical. It's like, hey, do your due diligence. Let's show that you mean business for a long enough time so that when you do come in and you dedicate your life to service, it actually means for something. Even though you are leaving the world behind, there's such a focus on responsibility and that dutifulness. So it's just fascinating, especially those who know that you are my teacher. And somehow or other, I feel all the more validated in my 16-year-old experience. And I'll just share for anyone, if you're not so fortunate to have been introduced to the Bhagavad Gita at 16, no problem. 20's also pretty good. 25's also great. 60's pretty great too. And a life could go by without ever even knowing about the Bhagavad Gita, what to speak of getting in touch with different versions, and especially the Bhagavad Gita as it is, which if you haven't read it, it's always going to be linked at our resources in the Conscious Success community in the show notes. So please make sure if you haven't already read that or listen to Audible, audiobook, there's many different ways you can listen to it and read it online. With the Bhagavad Gita, I do want to present, you've authored various books. One of my favorite books in the whole world is called The Four Questions, which few years, maybe 2 years ago, was released to the public. And I want to shout that out specifically because I know the first time I read the Bhagavad Gita, it was a lot. And I understood enough that I kept going, but there were certain parts that were, it was so dense and sometimes I felt full after just reading. It was so much information. And for those who might resonate with my experience of starting right with the Bhagavad Gita where it might feel like a lot, I really suggest and request you check out the Four Questions because it talks about the concepts of the Gita and it really creates a stepping stone for one to fully understand the purport of the Bhagavad Gita itself in a very authentic way. And I mean, it's my favorite book. I literally purchase boxes with many of them in just to like give out to friends as birthday gifts and stuff because it's touched my life so much. So with that, could you share just a little bit about the Four Questions or any of the other books that you've authored or some of the ones that you'll be releasing in the near future?
Sure. Four Questions is a way to practically approach spiritual life. And I've always felt that if you have a high-minded philosophy, but you don't have immediate access to it, then it's useless. And it's one of the teachings in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says, this should be experienced directly. And it always seems, often it seems that philosophies are lofty And then people are left wanting because they think, well, okay, I got my own problems. Plus I got to pay for the rent and all that stuff. So I'm not going to join an ashram. And so how do I do this? So in my own life, I've asked those questions as well, because after being a monk, I think at the perfect time for me, timing is everything. I married my wife, and she's also, she had a very similar story, although I didn't know her as a monk. We were introduced, and I entered into another phase of my life. And I saw from that, okay, there's a complex world out there that we have to deal with on a regular basis. I wanted to, for my own practical use, have tenets that I could keep in front of me all the time and come back to. Because no matter how intentional someone may be to practice something, unless you have a simple, clear philosophy and a way to apply it, it's so easy to go off track. In fact, I read one of Rick Warren's books, and he talked about this principle called the Jericho principle. When people were building the wall of Jericho, the person who was overseeing the project had to come back and remind them why they were building the wall every 30 days. And it became a principle that if you're doing something, you have to know why you're doing it and remind yourself. Otherwise, the mind is apt to go off in another track. Even within 5 minutes, that can happen. So I wanted to have in my own life simple principles that I could, that would help me to adhere to a life of integrity so that I would feel satisfied. Because I knew that if I wasn't able to follow it in the world, that is the Bhagavad Gita and what I had learned in an ashram, where it's much easier, then how would it help the world? Because most people don't live in an ashram. And I wanted to have that for my own life. So then over time, I started collecting these prompts for my own use. And then I started writing a blog. It was called Shravanadi Jal, which means how to pour water on your spiritual plant that's growing in your heart. That's Shravanadi means the spiritual practice, and Jal means water in Bengali. And I wrote that by looking at the world and seeing, how does this apply to normal circumstances? And so the four questions is just an offshoot of that thought process. And try to make it something that is commonplace and also that aligns with the ancient wisdom literatures, which actually start off with a statement that now that you're a human being, you should ask big questions. And the implication is if you ask the questions, the answers will be forthcoming. And that's a very interesting principle, because I had intuited that in the very beginning days of my practice, that if I was sincere, really wanted to know the truth, that it would come to me. And that means, in the way I was thinking about it, that the universe is responsive to me. So how to stay on track? So the four questions was a way to align myself with my ultimate purpose in life. In fact, the first question is, what's my purpose? And that kind of goes to the ideas about many excellent speakers talk about. Ask yourself why you're doing it before you do it. Stephen Covey, start with the end in mind. And then recently, getting to why, or ask the question, why are you doing? Why are you doing? So forth. And my writing teachers in school used to tell me, keep asking, why does this matter, what you're saying? And so forth. Then I felt, we can do that over and over again and ask it about life. Why not? And then the other questions had to do with how may I be of service? Because one of the points that Krishna makes in the Bhagavad Gita, that aligns us with our true nature. We're happiest when we're meaningfully engaged in doing service. That's something that matters, that helps other people. Otherwise, just accumulation weighs us down, and we feel, no matter how much we have, it feels burdensome. And another question is, what's the lesson? And every time I ask that question, the mind immediately second guesses it. Well, you're going to ask that? Why can't you just be a victim like everybody else? I'd rather wallow in it rather than try to get something out of it. And it's a discipline that is highly recommended in for instance, the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is a postgraduate study of the Bhagavad Gita, like keep asking, what's the lesson? And then finally, one that's so ultimately practical, which is, where am I investing my attention right now? And I coined this idea of ROA. There's ROI, everyone knows, return on investment. And I learned early on, after I was a monk, the power of compounded interest and how, if you want to be rich, I read a book called The Richest Man in Babylon and say, okay, I got the formula. I know how to do this now, even though I didn't have anything. And I just say, you have to, you know, take something out and invest it every month. And so then I was thinking, what's the most valuable asset I have? It's my attention. If I waste it for 1 second, I've wasted the most valuable asset I have. So ROA means return on attention. Where can I point my attention, or where should I at every given minute to get the best return on what I'm looking at? And I've been on a campaign, as you know, recently, making a not-to-do list. It's kind of caught on. People ask me about it everywhere. It's like, well, tell me about the not-to-do list. Well, it's really simple. Figure out what you're doing that you don't like. You hate yourself for it. It's like, why do I keep doing this? And write it down on the page and say, here are the two things I'm going to stop doing. And one of them I talk about is randomness, which can also be thought of as scrolling, not just on your phone. And I mean, and not get to get into all the details and get on a soapbox about why that's so bad for you, because there's plenty of evidence that, and everybody knows.
We are. Everyone's like, I know, why am I doing this? Can't put it down.
But it's even looking at the world in a random way. Hmm. Make a plan for your life. I think of it as a race. And, you know, have a strategy and try to use one whole lifetime for the highest possible cause. And that requires moment to moment questioning of where am I placing my attention right now. And also another idea that goes with that is success, or progress, I should say, is a series of comebacks. Nobody goes without making mistakes. That's also cliche practically to talk about, you know, fail forward fast and so forth. But there's a way in which, if I have a mechanism to keep bringing myself back to where I should be in each moment, then I'm making comebacks, because the mind's going to go off this way and that way. And asking myself the question, what's the best investment of my attention at this very moment? It's edifying, because then I realize, oh, I'm right here. I can make the choice. And I'd rather be looking at this. And it's something we talked about on the way over to the studio here, which was another concept, which is, if you don't like what you're being subjected to, then change the subject. And that came to me because I realized, looking at screens, and I notice they're everywhere nowadays. Every time I sit in an airplane, not every time, some of the newer ones don't have screens. They just leave it to your own. Because if you're, oh, they're addicted enough, they don't need another screen. Then I was watching some program, I was standing in line in a store, and they had a television at the end of right after you pay at the register. And I was watching it, and I hate what that guy's saying. I said to myself, well, why are you listening to it? Then I just realized that came to me, like, you don't like what you're being subjected to. Why are you doing this to me? It's like, why are you watching it, dummy? And then I thought, that applies to everything in my life. I get to choose. That's my free will, where I'm going to place my attention. So those, they're very practical guidelines for my own life. And then I just tried to express them in ways that people could also take them and just say, here, you want something that works? Ask a question. It's a hook that pulls you back into integrity with what you really want to do.
It's been maybe 14 years now where I've been listening to you share these topics. And one of my favorite things, you give sound bites that are easy to remember. You know, where attention goes, energy flows. If you don't like what you're hearing, change the subject, et cetera. And, you know, these four questions that you've been sharing for quite some years now, I actually turned in a little song so that I could remember it.
Oh, my goodness.
And so, okay, you guys, if you want to remember, it's real easy. What is my purpose and how can I be of service? What's the lesson and what's got my attention? Questions are the answer. There's a way in which I've seen so practically, coming back to these four questions, to your point of, instead of living a random life where you're practically just bound by the conditioned mind, whatever the coolest distraction is, you'll be pulled in that direction.
Even if it's not cool, you'll still get pulled. Yeah. This is for the sake of that, you know, that state of mind, which is just random.
I mean, most of the stuff my mind gets pulled, I would not define it as cool. It's like, yeah, it's whatever the sparkliest light is, whatever the brightest thing captivating.
Distraction for its own sake. It's a kind of a rut. And I hate that. I love the creative process where I know I'm alive and I know I'm actually getting original ideas. They're coming from within. They're coming from, and then I feel that I'm hitting the source, you know, that I'm hearing that voice within. And when I'm letting somebody else take over my mind and just sell something, I don't know what their intention is. Are they really trying to help me or they just want me to buy something and so forth? I just wanted to mention about the questions are very important for relationships also. As I find in communication, I read this in a book years ago, that whoever's asking questions is leading the conversation. But I find it, that can even sound manipulative, you know, using it in that way. But I found that oftentimes, and this is another point, this book on rhetoric, the author mentioned that oftentimes people are talking about something, but they don't know what the subject is, or they don't know, they forget the purpose of their conversation. So I've found oftentimes in communicating with people, they'll say something that may be hard to understand or irritating even. Have you ever had that
it's
experience?
I'll have to theoretically accept it. Yeah.
And then I remember this point that he made. It's like, well, ask for clarity. Keep asking. And in that way, the question becomes a tool to actually have a better relationship with people. Try to get clarity about what they mean by what they're saying, rather than assuming that I know and trying to answer something. Wait for a pitch that you can hit and keep asking until you get that pitch, not to be manipulative, but to really try to understand the person. That's when you said questions are the answer. Oftentimes when I'm confronted with something where I don't understand what the person's saying, or it seems annoying or off-putting in some way, it's like, okay, just ask questions until you get to the real heart of the matter. And that it works in esoteric, existential terms, asking questions, but also as far as interpersonal relationships, be more sensitive to what the other person's thinking. And the question is the hook that really brings it out. Like, if you know somebody, you think you know somebody really well, but then you see them every day and you really don't talk to them very deeply. I mean, some people can go a whole day without having a meaningful conversation. It's just routine. I found that my wife and I have gotten into this discipline of taking time to actually talk deeply and ask each other questions. How are you feeling? How are you really feeling? Until you go 3, 4, 5, 6 layers deep. And then the relationship becomes much more encouraging when you know how one another are feeling and what's really on your mind. And sometimes I don't know what I'm feeling until somebody asks me, or she doesn't know. So having that exchange regularly can be really helpful.
So it's tools for both practical communication and relationships that can help provide clarity, as well as with more elusive or enigmatic spiritual topics. And it's a framework that anyone could keep in their back pocket. And if you're like me and you struggle with a little social anxiety sometimes, you don't know what to talk about too, I use these as conversation starters.
Tell me.
Well, it's like, what are you focused on in life? Like, what lights you up? You know, what is your purpose? Or like, you know, is there anything that you find yourself spending time to contribute? Any like service you engage? And I use these as almost like conversation starters of sorts, because honestly, no one likes small talk anyway. The weather's nice. Yeah, cool. You know, it's like, it's so draining. And so these questions, so practical, as you so eloquently expressed, for things that we're faced with day in and day out, relationships we want to cultivate, as well as bigger topics. And it's like a digging tool. You talk about how it's a hook. You know, it's also like a sickle that you could dig with.
That's right.
It's like the question, it hooks attention, but it also you can get into deeper, as you mentioned, deeper layers as well. And you have these different catchphrases isn't the term, but these, it's like little pills you can keep in your back pocket. This always see them, these four questions and some others that you share, you just, when you need them, you pop them in to recalibrate. Why am I doing this anyway? What am I focused on? Oh, what's got my attention? Oh, what seemingly stole my attention? No, this is my control. This is my agency. And you brought up this point, which is just so exactly what we do here on Conscious Success. You define conscious success maybe without even intentionally doing so, where success is, and if you could just reiterate, you said success is
a series of comebacks. Saying progress, to move forward, be willing to make comebacks on very tiny level, because oftentimes, like for instance in meditation, sometimes people get frustrated when they're meditating because they're like, where was I? I thought I was meditating, and now I'm in anxiety because I'm thinking about something else. Don't become discouraged. Hmm. Just have a place to come back to and keep doing that. That's practical in meditation. It's practical in reading a book. If you've ever read a book and you finished a paragraph and you said, I have no idea what I just read, but you know you read it, right? And we can do that in any aspect of our life. And so this gift we have, which is the freedom to exercise our attention to whatever level we wish. It takes discipline, it takes practice. And that's why I'm anti-scrolling, because you sort of train our mind in the opposite way, just to be whimsical and random. And then when we actually want to get serious, the mind won't cooperate because we've already practiced something else that keeps it on the run.
Too long of a leash. Yeah. Well, and that's certainly the best definition we've had of conscious success, which is what we spend so much time, this whole podcast is dedicated to, is deliberately or consciously, conscientiously bringing your attention back to what's important so that you can be successful. And I think that's another one of those little pills they keep in, is, am I being consciously successful? Am I doing that series of comebacks? Or as you mentioned, you know, the idea of meditation, like what's taught in the Bhagavad Gita, is meditation is when you grab the mind and bring it back. That idea of recalibrating, but consciously, not just being on default autopilot, taking the attention and say, where do I want my attention to be here, and grabbing it. And I think I've heard you tell the story. The short version is, a sage goes and visits a king in a big, beautiful palace, and is welcomed very royally, and he's, you know, gifted with all these lovely, luxurious gifts. And then the king says, you know, sage, I'm struggling with this, that, the other. This has got my attention. You know, I'm dealing with all these citizens, which are causing me headache, and my family's causing me a headache, and all these things are causing me all of these problems. Can you believe these things are causing me so much stress and problems? And then the sage walks up to a pillar, as the story is told, wraps his arms and legs around the pillar, squeezes and says, mm-hmm. Help, help, someone help, the pillar's got me. And indicating to the king this idea that all you have to do is, yeah, let go of the pillar. And in the same way as you're so expertly expressing, that it's our agency, it's our choice to consciously say, yeah, let's let go of the pillar. Like, I don't have to be watching this TV. I don't have to be sucked into the phone or whatever scrolling might be there. And that's one thing I really appreciate about your practical instruction on this. I'm not only in my own life, but I bring the attention to it, because otherwise you're just caught into a whirlwind of so much. So just the nature of the world is to cause you enough fear to keep you present and keep consuming and keep watching. And this is the way to break that cycle in a very practical way. And so I'm wondering, what are some of the other practices, behaviors, strategies of sorts, like a not-to-do list, knowing what you don't want to spend your attention on, like using these four questions. Like, what are some other behaviors, practical advice one could follow?
One of the big ones is attention. Just studying what attention means. Like, I'm looking at you right now, and I know you're there, and I'm cognizant of you. And what's actually hitting you? You know, it's not a light beam like from a flashlight or something. Or if you're driving down the, what do we got here, the 5?
Yeah, something like that.
Driving the 5 and you look at somebody next to you in the car. Why are you looking at me? what did you do? What happened there? What is that came out of your eyes that is hit the other person and made them react? It's your attention. So the topic itself, attention, how does the word ten? Ten is the Latin word which means to stretch, and it also has this implication of connecting to other things, like a tendon connects muscle to bone. So we connect to the world by our attention. And this is one of the topics in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna talks about consequences. That's another word I like. You do something and there's an unfoldment of situations that naturally come from it. So he warns us about the way that we interact with the world where we entangle ourselves, and giving one's attention or contemplating certain objects, for instance, categorically that are temporary, and thinking that you're going to be able to keep them. That's called, in the ancient teachings, it's called avidya, or ignorance of how to interact with the world in the proper way. So you have to know where to put your attention. But on the positive side, talking about what you can do to improve your life right now, today, immediately, 5 minutes from now, 5 seconds from now, and that is, in your relationships, give full attention. See if it doesn't freak out your significant other. As soon as he or she says something, you just turn your chairs. Oh, really? And give not half attention, not 90%, but 100%. How often do we do that? Notice what happens when you do that. And then you'll realize how much power you have in the relationship to make it sanguine. And if you do that with other people, in fact, people are so used to not giving attention that you can walk by people and go, how are you? Terrible. Oh, great. I mean, I don't even
Postscript,
listen.
Yeah.
And people try to kind of avoid contact. I play this game when I walk early in the morning before the sun comes up. I like to take an early morning walk just when the birds are getting up. And there's some dog walkers out sometimes because they got to go out early when they like to. And as I'm walking past, I was like, play this game, you know, like, are they going to look at me? Am I going to look at them? Yeah. And am I going to say good morning? And it's a very interesting study of like, why are, you know, there's another living being there and they have consciousness, and how are we going to interact? The axiom is that the quality of the attention we give to other people determines the quality of our lives. And if you just adjust that one thing in whatever relationships you have with others in your life, either casual acquaintances or those that you love very much, just consider how much attention have you given them. And a little bit goes a long way, because we're more powerful than we think. Mm-hmm. And if we withhold our attention from people, that's the most torturous thing you can do to someone. You mentioned it just now. It's like, you don't look at somebody. Well, you get in an elevator. I'm not saying you should be all like,
hey,
all over everybody, wherever you go. But just consider you get in an elevator with one other person, and you just go, dum-de-dum-de-dum. Should I even look up? You know, it's daunting. But the fact is, if we ignore somebody, like, ignorance means ignorance. We're not looking at the person. And it's painful. It causes darkness in our life. One of the worst things you can do is just not talk to somebody when you should. Like, people do that sometimes. Like, okay, I'm not talking to them. That's it. And maybe you're in the same house. And then how does that feel? Great? No, not so much. So if you reverse that and think, how can I be appropriately attentive to each person? When they give me attention, then I give it back. And you just see that that's an axiomatic principle that works everywhere, even with animals. And you look at an animal, like, hey, you know, I see you there. And they're like, yeah, I see you too.
Conscious spark.
They know, like, you look at a cat on the corner, like, you're a cool cat. And the cat comes over, like, yeah,
you're
pretty
not too
cool
shabby
too.
Yourself. Yeah.
It's the experiment of consciousness. And it's so simple, but it's immediate. And another principle that I got during the pandemic is called workarounds bring turnarounds. We turned it into a kind of a logo, mantra, battle cry for our different teams. And workarounds bring turnarounds, because I started realizing during the pandemic, in one of the projects I'm working with, we became a lot more attentive internationally. We were much more North American centric. And then because everyone was home and accessible through Skype, Zoom, and all that, it was Zoom. Then I started reaching out with projects that different participants around the world could be involved in. And I started realizing very quickly, people don't all think the same. They have different ways of doing things. You know, at first I thought, well, of course they should do it my way. You know, we already came up with this, the whole campaign set up. So, you know, why don't you just do it? And then I started realizing that that doesn't work so well. And I considered how, if I just relax and try to figure out, try to think more, how can I work around the situation? I often find that there's a much better way to do it. And I only discover it when I'm able to sublimate my own ego, that it has to be my way. And therefore I came up with this phrase, workarounds bring turnarounds. And it really helps, because the idea of when I make an ultimatum, then the game's over.
Yeah.
And then you just have this position where, you know, you have to defend yours and it's stuck for the rest of your life. So those are a couple more, just like quality of the attention you give people will determine the quality of your relationship, and workarounds bring turnarounds.
Well, it gives full agency too. It's such a relief. It's like you're giving us permission. Like, yeah, you're driving, and all you got to do to change your quality of life is change the thing you're giving your attention to. Improve the quality of the recipient of your attention, the quality of the rest of your life will improve. Well, with that, and because we've got a festival we're going to have to get to shortly, one of the most important things, that the reason I wanted to say this for the end is, as they say, the good rule of show business is you always leave the audience wanting more, is why bhakti? Because everything that you're talking about here, it's like where to give your attention. It's like, why would we want to give our attention to God, which is really the process of bhakti yoga in a very authentic, authorized way that's practically experienced. So the culmination of everything you suggested is directly applicable to our relationship with God, and give your attention there. And so out of all of the processes, literatures, I know you didn't necessarily mention now, but I just know that you've studied probably more philosophical and theological topics, understandings, processes out there. What is it about bhakti yoga that, in your assessment, makes it the most worthwhile to give our attention to?
It is personal. And it goes back to I didn't know what bhakti meant, but I did. And that first advertisement I saw in a magazine for these other books, I saw something I hadn't seen anywhere else. And it was an advertisement for the book called Sri Ishopanishad. And most people have heard Upanishads. They're thousands of years old. And it said in the advertisement for the book that the ancient Upanishads say that the ultimate truth is personal. That means everything comes from a personal source. And when I read that, I thought, well, finally somebody said something about this, because all the other books I read had an amorphous idea that I was the supreme and that I just didn't know it and I'd forgotten. And then when they talked about prayer and mantra and things, I thought, well, who am I praying to? Myself? That didn't make sense. It didn't resonate. But the idea of a personal source, it excited me. I thought, wow, I want to find out more about that. And the more I studied it from a logical point of view, philosophical point of view, the more sense it made. I used to look at kids. I know when I was in kindergarten, every finger painting I made had a face on it. Like the sky, the sun, the house, everything. Kids do that because it's kind of a natural to personify everything. And that's because everything's personal, and that's because it comes from a personal source. And if there's a personal source who's benevolently providing everything, or there's a reason behind why there's suffering in the world that is understandable, that it's not something that is left in an abstract way, then I can have a relationship with that original source that's benevolent. And that's what attracted me to it, that it was a relief for me to find out that there was an intelligent and intelligible source to everything. And it had to be personal. So I like that aspect of bhakti. The other aspect I love about bhakti is it's aesthetically pleasing. Mm. In fact, you mentioned the festival we're going to. So it has every artistic flair, flower garland making, the building of splendid chariots. There's music festival. That's why I have to go back. I have a little part to play in that. I brought my band with me from Northern California. And then the food, the art, the pageantry of the festival is like, when I first saw that back in 1973, I thought, oh, that sounds much better than fasting and and going to the Himalayas and just being an ascetic. I mean, that appealed to me too, in another sense that I was really frustrated with the world. But then when I saw it could be spiritualized, that also resonated, that we need that. And when it's used for the proper purpose, it becomes the ultimate fulfillment, what we're all looking for. That's why I like bhakti.
And that's why I like hearing you teach it. Gurudev, I can't begin to express the amount of gratitude I have for at least the last 14 years that I've gotten to personally benefit from your teachings, from the at least tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands of people that I know are benefiting from what you're sharing on a regular basis, including everyone contributing and listening here. I can't advise strongly enough, more than maybe anything I've ever endorsed, to please check out these resources in the show notes so that you can not only hear, I mean, so many classes, hundreds, if not maybe thousands of classes available online, the Four Questions book, Our Family Business. I know there's some other books in the works as well. And I humbly request you personally, as me, Madhu, personally requesting you to not only purchase these literatures, but at least consume, gift your attention this knowledge and information coming from such an authorized source. You know, our special guest has spent over 5 decades not only learning all this information, but being the example that we all want to emulate in this world of what it looks like to actually be cool and spiritual simultaneously, to be the emblem of conscious success. And I'm so excited to coerce you into another one of these, which I don't think will be difficult, so that we can keep this conversation going. Again, we have some aesthetically pleasing and beautiful music and kirtan to get to now. But for, as always, for everyone who enjoys these topics, all I'll ever ask you to do is subscribe. That's the only thing, so that the algorithm knows that to share this with more cool cats like you, and to let us know that we're contributing in a way that's actually meaningful. That's all I'll ever ask. You can join our Conscious Success community, where we give all this tools, knowledge, and resources away for free as well. The main thing is just keep showing up, keep consuming transcendental topics like this. As you often say, keep the transcendental sound vibration going. And this is an example of ways that enliven us towards transcendental sound. And before we close up, are there any last notes you'd like to leave us with?
Yeah, you're doing that. And I'm really proud of you, and I love what you're doing. And I look forward to getting to know your audience better. Thanks for doing what you're doing. It's really important.
Well, we're going to do it again. Thank you, Guru Maharaj.
Thank you very much.